Book of Samuel, chapter 4. Last week, we did chapters 1 to 3, and we can see here that in the history of Israel, we have many important lessons. What to do, what not to do, what people did wrong, what people did right. Now we come to another section from chapter 4 to 7. Let me read to you some of the verses of chapter 4. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped again beside Ebenezer. And the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. And when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh, that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now let's look at this picture here. Israel were out of tune with God. The priests, the sons of Eli, were ungodly. And yet they are unaware of this sin in their midst. And we find that they are puzzled by what has happened. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? None so blind as those who will not see. There was sin in the camp. And they should have known from their history, when Joshua was defeated, it was because there was sin in the camp. And here was a case where there was sin in the camp. The moral is obvious. How can we expect God's blessings when there is sin tolerated, when there's evil being committed and people are turning a blind eye to it? There's a difference when people don't know. God will tell us. In the case of Joshua, he said to Joshua, "Stop lying like this before me on your face. Get up, there's sin in the camp." He told Joshua. Joshua did not know. But here was something they did know about. And the one who should have done something about it, who was the judge of Israel, Eli, the high priest, he did nothing about it. But then they thought, well, the remedy for that is to bring the Ark into the camp. There was a superstition that God was going to be with the Ark. If they brought the Ark, then they brought God, because that was a replica of the throne of God. And so if they brought God into the camp, they became invincible. And that is the kind of error that they repeated more than once, trying to tie God down to his institutions. If we do this, or if we proceed in this way, then God is obligated to do something for us. It doesn't work like that. That's the mentality, that's the mindset. But it doesn't work like that. There are certain moral laws, there are certain inevitable laws of cause and effect. And even God himself constricts himself or restricts himself to those rules. So when the Ark of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly, "Hooray, we've got our God with us." That's a kind of mistake that believers still commit today. They're sure, they say, if you do this and this, you're guaranteed of success. But there are other conditions too. Yes, certainly do this and this, which is legitimate, But look at the other issues. Is everything else in order? Is everything else in place? Is everything else right? Remember last week or 2 weeks ago, they were just about to launch one of those shuttles, and a few seconds before blast off, they shut down because the computer was malfunctioning. It was not registering pressure somewhere or something like that. So they shut it down. Everything else was set to go. The fuel was in the tanks, the astronauts were strapped in, everything else, all systems were go, except for this one little troublesome computer. And because of that, they aborted the launch. Well, that's what we need to do in our walk with God. Is everything in place? How are we to know? That's the problem. How are we to know that everything is in place? Well, here's a safe rule to go by. Let's look at Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3. Here's something comforting for us. How are we to know? Well, here's a basic rule. Philippians 3, that's on page 1018 in our brown Bibles. He says in verse 14, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Messiah Yeshua. Therefore let us, as many as are mature, have this mind. And if in anything you think otherwise, God will reveal even this to you. There you are. Is there something I've overlooked? All you need to do is to go to the Lord and say, Lord, is there anything I've overlooked? He will show you. He will tell you. He who reads the hearts knows that you mean to serve him, that you mean to obey him. He won't leave you in ignorance. He'll put his finger on the thing that might spoil your chances or that might mar your happiness. But he goes on to say in verse 16, nevertheless, to the degree that we have already attained, let us walk by the same rule, let us be of the same mind. We're not perfect, we're growing like a tree, like a fruit tree. It doesn't bring a full-grown, luscious fruit in its first year. But every year as you cultivate it and as it grows and as it gets stronger, the fruit improves. And he says, just keep on cultivating. Keep on cultivating your spiritual life, and this is the rule to follow. Press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Messiah Yeshua. Just keep pressing on the upward way. New heights you will gain every day. So that's the lesson we can learn from here. But let's see now the reaction of the Philistines from verse 6. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, what does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean? Then they understood that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also, the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, died. Here were these heathens, and they realized that they were no match for God. They could never win. But it's interesting. Not only did they have a memory of what God had done, they also appreciated his power, and they knew they didn't stand a chance. But although the case was desperate, although it looked hopeless, they said, "Very well, let's die nobly." Now there's a lesson that you and I can learn. The Bible tells us to lift up the hands which hang down, to strengthen those feeble knees, make straight paths for our feet, not to be discouraged. Look at the example of these heathens and take encouragement from them. See this, these people who were faced with black despair. Okay, it's all over for us, but let's be men. Let's be men. And the new covenant says the same things. Watch, stand fast in the faith. Quit you like men. Be strong. These are the four rules that must always challenge us. Never give up. When God is on your side, you have no reason to. These people felt that they had God against them, and yet they wouldn't give up. But what a contrast with Israel. What a contrast. They didn't remember about God who brought them out of Egypt. They didn't remember his power. They didn't obey him and submit to him as their God. They had been disobeying. Remember, in the days of Samuel, it was in the days of the judges, when every man did that which was right in his own eyes. We're still in that era where people were living ungodly lives and yet thinking that because they were God's people and because they had his ark, therefore nothing could go wrong with them. Tying God down. So the Philistines fought. Conduct your men, yourselves like men and fight, they said. They did. In fact, their very despair added energy to the battle. You know, when people say, okay, this is it, I'll see how many I can bring down with me when I go down. Like Samson, let me die with the Philistines. And he pulled down the house upon himself and upon the Philistines. He tried to slay as many as he could in his own death. And in the same way, these Philistines were doing what Samson had done. Let's see how many we can bring down with us. And marvel of marvels, they won. They captured the ark. And to them, that was, to their mindset, they had captured the God of Israel. Because in the heathen philosophy, their God was represented by an object, usually by a figure. In the case of the Israelites, they understood that the ark represented the God of Israel. So if they captured this idol, they captured the God that that idol represented. And they found, to their amazement, or so they thought, they were stronger than that mighty God of Israel who had conquered the Egyptians. They must have been preening themselves. But we'll see what happens later on, and we find that God is quite able to take care of his own reputation. The ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, died. God had meant them to die, and so they did. They died. Verse 12, then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. Now when he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, what does the sound of this tumult mean? And the man came hastily and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Then the man said to Eli, I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line. And he said, what happened, my son? So the messenger answered and said, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also your two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. Then it happened, when he made mention of the Ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. He died on hearing the sad news. He had judged Israel for 40 years, but alas, he was a bad father, and he had not judged his own sons for the sins that they had committed. How do you imagine it would have turned out if he had penalized his sons, removed them at least from the priesthood, and told them, you can't serve because you're committing adultery and because you're abusing God's ordinances. Out you go until you repent. In fact, the Torah said that anyone committed adultery was worthy of death. But Eli couldn't do that to his own two sons. He didn't do anything except mildly expostulate with them. And the result was that he brought down not only his two sons, he not only lost his own life, but he brought down the nation of Israel. 30,000 of them died in that battle, and in the previous day, 4,000. 34,000 altogether died because the judge of Israel was not doing what he was meant to do. What a responsibility. It doesn't it show us how responsible we are? Yeshua says to us, we are salt and we are light. How responsible it is for us to walk with him. You may think nobody's taking notice, but if you're walking with Yeshua, you are having an influence. People may not, you may not realize it, but people do. A friend of mine told me that when he became a believer, he wasn't sure that he was a believer. He had certainly put his trust in Yeshua, but no feelings, no assurance, no certainty that he was a believer. He's standing at a bus stop, and as he was getting on the bus stop, someone who was there in the bus line or just getting off the bus said, God bless you, brother. I can see that you're a Christian. Now, isn't that something? From a perfect stranger, he got his answer. It was something on his face. That look, that change of expression, those eyes. Someone said that you can sometimes tell by people's eyes when they love God. Well, in this case, Eli had brought disaster upon, not only on himself and his family, but on his people, because he had not been walking with God the way he should. Tragedy. And not only that, but he lost his daughter-in-law and his grandson. Verse 19. Now his daughter-in-law, Pinchas's wife, was with child, due to be delivered. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her labor pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said to her, do not fear, for you have borne a son. But she did not answer, nor did she regard it. Then she named the child Ichavod. Where is the glory? Saying, the glory has departed from Israel, because the Ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband. And she said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured. Where is the glory? Or no glory. Ichavod can mean either Echavod, where is the glory, or it can be Ichavod, that means no glory. Both come to the same thing. There is no glory. But now the Philistines, flushed with triumph, not only overran the city of Shiloh, the town of Shiloh. That's why the people cried out when they heard the news. We know from the Psalms, we know from the prophet Jeremiah, that Shiloh was devastated by the Philistines. God says to his people, go to Shiloh and see what I did there to my house because of the wickedness of my people Israel. That's in Jeremiah 7, verse 12. And also in Psalm 78, we read about Shiloh destroyed. So there was disaster, devastation in Shiloh. Now these Philistines, flushed with victory, we are stronger than the God of Israel. We read about them in chapter 5. They brought the ark to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Eben-Ezer to Ashdod. Isn't that interesting? You know that place, Eben-Ezer? That's the place where Israel were defeated because of their ungodliness. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. You've seen pictures of mermaids, haven't you? Well, this was a merman. You know what I mean? The top half was man, the bottom half was fish. And Dagon comes from the Hebrew word dag, which means fish. Dagon. There's a huge silo near Haifa, and it's called Dagon. What a name to give it. Anyway, they brought it down and they set it by their God. Hear, O our God, is the God of Israel. You have helped us to prevail over these mighty gods who smote Egypt with all the plagues in Israel. And they put the ark there as the captive of their idol. But look what happened in verse 3 to 5. And when the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set it in its place again. And when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both the palms of its hands were broken off on the threshold. Only the torso of Dagon was left of it. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any who come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. What an irony. They saw their idol fallen before the ark, and if they had been thinking people, or if they had stopped to think, they were thinking people, they were fairly cultured people. In fact, the archaeologists have brought to light the fact that they were really quite civilized in the way we call civilized, cultured. But where religion is concerned, reason takes flight. We can say this about faith in Yeshua: it is not opposed to reason, it is the highest reason. But in this case, they don't stop to think. They didn't stop to think. They had emotional presuppositions. This is our God. How could this happen to our God? What they should have thought was this: if our God falls before this ark, then that's proof that this, the God whom this ark represents, is superior to ours. But they didn't learn the lesson. So they propped him up again. The next morning, its head and its hands were cut off and they were lying on the threshold. Now, that should have been proof positive to them that their idol was nothing and that it was the God of Israel whom they should worship. No. All they did was to get rid of that ark, send it away somewhere else. And out of reverence to their idol, who was so terribly desecrated, they wouldn't step on the threshold. When they came to the threshold of the temple, they wouldn't step on the threshold because that's where the head and the hands of this fish god were found. So out of reverence, they would hop over it, jump over it. We get a reference to that in the prophet Zephaniah, chapter 1 and verse 9. God says, I will punish all those that leap on the threshold. That's in Zephaniah 1:9. But still we can learn from them. Even though they were so terribly in error, we can learn from them. See how reverent they were. And what a rebuke to Israel, who were being so sacrilegious in their behavior. What a rebuke to those who trample on matters that are truly sacred. What a warning. What an example we can learn from them. Then comes a plague. Then came a plague. Verse 6 to 9. But the hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod, and he ravaged them and struck them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. Our footnote says probably it was the bubonic plague. That's quite possible. And so they decided, send the ark away. And they sent it to Gath. Verse 9. And so it was after they had carried it away that the hand of the Lord was against the city, that's the city of Gath, with a very great destruction. So, verse 10, therefore they sent the ark of God to Ekron. So it was as the ark of God came to Ekron that the Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought the ark of God. They have brought the ark of the God of Israel to us, to kill us and our people. They cried, and their cry went up to heaven. They learned to their cost that they could not fool around with the God of Israel. He was still the mighty God of Israel who had smitten Egypt, and now they are feeling his hand for themselves. And they realized he had lost nothing of his power. And whatever the reason was that they had captured the ark, it was not because he had no power. It was for something else. They learned their lesson. And the result was they decided, send it back, send it back. So we come to chapter 6. Now the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners, saying, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it to its place. So they said, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return it to him with a trespass offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. And so they did that. The priests went on to say to them in verse 6, why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? When he did mighty things among them, did they not let the people go that they might depart? So they said, don't be as stubborn as Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Listen to us. Send the ark away. And so they did. They put it on a cart, and they said in verse 9, watch, if it goes up the road to its own territory, to Beit Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us. It was by chance that it happened to us. So they sent the ark back. They sent it with 2 milk cows, hitched them to the cart, verse 10, and shut up their calves at home. Verse 12. Then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh and went along the highway, lowing as they went. Lowing but going, as someone put it. The people of Beth Shemesh were delighted to find it. Verse 14. Then the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stood there. A large stone was there. So they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Verse 16. So when the 5 lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron the same day. And so they said, now we know that it was God's hand upon us. It was not something that happened by chance. We can't fool around with the God of Israel. Whatever the faults of Israel, we can't fool around with their God. Beth Shemesh was a Levitical city. It was a city populated by the Levites. The Levites did not have tribal inheritance. They just lived in cities that were dotted throughout Israel. They were meant to be the resident teachers of the people and also ministers at God's house. So they were dispersed throughout Israel. And Beth Shemesh was the best place the ark could go, because the Levites would know what to do with the ark, and they would know how to handle it. It wasn't just the ark itself, but it was covered with a blue cloth so that nobody could see it, because God said, keep the ark covered unless it is in the most holy place. Only in the most holy place can you take the cover off the ark. But if anybody sees the ark without its cover on it, they will die. The Levites knew this. But they did something that the Philistines never did. They lifted the covering off. They ignored the warning. Verse 19. Then he struck the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. Hey, this is the ark. Let's see that golden pot that has manna. Let's look at those two tablets of stone on which the Ten Commandments are written. Maybe we'll also see Aaron's rod that budded, that bore blossoms and bore almonds. Let's have a look. An ungodly and unholy prying into things forbidden. He struck 50,000 and 70 men of the people. And the people lamented because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. Now, it's not quite sure whether all those who were struck died. Many of them may have, but it's not sure that all of them did. What did they do when they looked into the ark? They removed the lid. And the lid was the mercy seat. The mercy seat was supposed to be between them and the law which they had broken. And that was their protection. When they removed their protection, they were exposed to the offended law which they had broken. No mercy seat between it and them. And that plague ravaged them. Verse 20. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before this holy Lord God? And to whom shall it go up from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Yearim, saying, the Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up with you. Then the men of Kiriath Yearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. Not only Philistines, but Israelites learn it's very dangerous to play with the God of Israel. So we come to chapter 7. The ark remained 20 years in Kiriath Yearim. Verse 2. So it was that the ark remained in Kiriath Yearim a long time. It was there 20 years. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. They were so bereft, the people of Israel. Oh, what have we done to offend our God? They lamented after the Lord. Samuel, by now, was a young man. 20 years had passed by. He was a few years old when he came to Shiloh. So he'd be about 25, maybe 30. Verse 3. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths from among you, and prepare your hearts for the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. Have you ever come across the person who says, I've been praying and praying and praying, and God doesn't hear me? Usually the answer is, there's an idol somewhere in your life. That's how it was with the people of Israel. Lamenting after the Lord. And someone says, well, if you really are returning to the Lord with all your hearts, what are those little statues doing on your mantelpiece at home? What are those groves with their idols doing? So many times we blame God because our condition doesn't improve, because our distress continues. If we were to ask God and he was to answer us, he'd say, there's an idol. Get rid of that idol. Now, it may not be obvious to us, but remember that text. If in anything you be otherwise minded, God shall reveal even this to them. And God had his man to tell them. God has his man to tell us, or his woman, these days too. It might be a kind friend, a prayer partner, someone who is a prayer warrior. They are able to say to you, have you thought of this? Or what could it be this? They might, without realizing it, put their finger on just the thing. That's what Samuel did. So he said, put away these idols. If you want to have God as your God, he is exclusive. He tolerates no rivals. So verse 4, the children of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths and served the Lord only. They showed the reality of their repentance. What a wonderful thing that even then, after 20 years or more of idol worship, God was still willing to take them back. And I say this for your encouragement. There may come a time in your life where you feel, this is it, God will never take me back now. He will. Yeshua says, him that comes to me, I will in no wise cast out. However displeased he is with you, whatever you've done, there is forgiveness with him. When you truly repent, once he has accepted you as his child, he knew from the beginning of eternity what you would do, and he took you in all the same. He's not going to change his mind now. That's something we must hold on to. Because the devil, our conscience, and even well-meaning people will make us feel rotten, will help us to get desperate, will help on our feeling of total rejection. You mustn't let it. You must. The only thing God says is, only acknowledge your iniquity and I will receive you back. Only say, Lord, I'm sorry, I have done this. I'm sorry, I won't do it anymore. That's it. Wonderful thing is God never mentions it again. When he forgives, he forgets. He never mentions it again. Same with husband and wife. I don't know why this thought comes to me, but as husband and wife, we must be very careful to let bygones be bygones. Now, Samuel said, verse 5, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. So they gathered together at Mizpah, drew water, and poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mizpah. He was already well accredited as God's messenger. And they could trust him because God let none of Samuel's words fall to the ground. So they met together for a special prayer and fasting meeting. A meeting for prayer and fasting. And the Philistines heard about it. And they came up to attack Israel. Verse 7. Now when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel had gathered together at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. Let me carry on the personal analogy. You realize that is something that you need to put right with God, and you're fully intent on doing it, and you've begun to do it, the devil will dog your heels. He'll try his best to terrorize you, to terrify you, to deter you, to stop you in your tracks, like those Philistines tried to stop the people of Israel. He dogs the heels of the repentant sinner. But the important thing is not to give up, but to continue to pray. And God will help you, because that's what happened there. Verse 9. Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. Then Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. Now as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a loud thunder upon the Philistines that day, and so confused them that they were overcome before Israel. There was a total rout of those Philistines. And then we read in verse 12, then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen and called its name Eben Ezer, the stone of help, saying, thus far the Lord has helped us. Ebenezer. Now in chapter 5, we read that's chapter 4, that's where they were defeated. Israel, chapter 4, verse 1, Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek. The place of their defeat became the place of their triumph. What made the difference? Repentance. There are areas in which you and I have been badly beaten, badly defeated. We've fallen foully. But when we've repented and turned to God and we've asked his forgiveness, he will make that defeat into a victory. And so the same place which witnessed the terrible slaughter of over 30,000 men of Israel was now a witness to the slaughter of their enemies. God turned the situation around. He turned the tables on the enemies. So we read in verse 13, so the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more into the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And we read at the end of verse 14, also there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. He not only subdued the Philistines, but there was also peace between Israel and their old enemies, the Amorites. There's a proverb that says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. That's a wonderful thing. So the Philistines were subdued, the cities were restored, but Samuel didn't leave it at that. He was a wise man. You have to consolidate your gains. Have you made gains, spiritual gains in your life? You must consolidate them. And there is only one way. That is through the living word of our God. And so we read verse 15. So Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. He went from year to year on a circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah, and judged Israel in all those places. But he always returned to Ramah, for his home was there. That's where his parents were. That's where he was born. So he wasn't completely and permanently away from Ramah. He finally moved there and lived there. There he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So he returned to his family home as a young man. And his mother, who had lent him to the Lord, found that the Lord lent him back to her. And she had the satisfaction for the rest of her life of seeing her son in that preeminent position of a good man and a judge of her people. And how she must have blessed God to the last day of her life, that God not only blessed her with such a son, but gave her the chance to see his blessing on her son. What a wonderful thing it is to give us ourselves to God. I used to think as a young believer, if I give myself and all I have to God, then I'm going to lose. He'll take it all away. That was the panicky thought that came across my mind. It didn't happen. I found that when I gave myself to him, he gave himself to me and all that he had. And I wasn't poor, I was rich. And that the very things I was afraid of losing were more sure and more certain and safe because they were in his keeping and not in mine. His grasp is stronger than mine. Well, there you are. That is the thrilling episode we read about Samuel, God's man.